This CLE course is based on summaries of New York State appellate decisions dealing with issues related to civil procedure, which were released in March of 2019. The summaries of these decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website, and they have been compiled in an update pamphlet for March 2019. That update pamphlet is available on the New York Appellate Digest website, and it constitutes the written materials for this CLE course. The first case in this March 2019 civil procedure update pamphlet is Andreeva versus New York Healthcare, which is on page 5. It's an administrative law case, and it comes out of the Court of Appeals. In a full-fledged opinion by Judge Rivera, over a two-judge dissent, reversing the appellate division, the Court of Appeals held that the Department of Labor's interpretation of a minimum wage order applicable to home health aides was not irrational or unreasonable. The court said, "The common issue presented in these appeals is whether, pursuant to the wage order, an employer must pay its home health care aide employees for each hour of a 24-hour shift. The Department of Labor has interpreted its wage order to require payment for at least 13 hours of a 24-hour shift if the employee is allowed a sleep break of at least 8 hours and actually receives 5 hours of uninterrupted sleep and 3 hours of meal break time. The Department of Labor's interpretation of its wage order does not conflict with the promulgated language, nor has the Department of Labor adopted an irrational or unreasonable construction. So the appellate division erred in rejecting the Department of Labor's interpretation." Next is the Rogowski Farm case, which is on page 6. It deals with the 30-day time limit to file a notice of appeal. The Second Department, in a full opinion by Justice Dillon, held that the 30-day period for filing a notice of appeal pursuant to CPLR 5513A is triggered for all parties when any party serves the other parties with the order or judgment appealed from with the written notice of entry. The court said, "The language of CPLR 5513A as to who serves notice of entry is not limited to the prevailing party or to the appealing party or to the party seeking to limit an adversary's appellate time. Rather, a party, which is unrestricted, necessarily refers to any party to an action. As a result, the service of an order or judgment with written notice of entry commences the 30-day time to appeal as to not only the party performing the service, but as to all other parties as well." Next is the Wright case. On page 7, it deals with the dead man statute. It's a medical malpractice case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the medical malpractice and wrongful death actions should have been dismissed. With respect to the lack of informed consent cause of action, the court held that the submission of the informed consent form, which was signed by the decedent, did not violate the dead man statute. The court wrote, "An adverse party's introduction of a document authored by a deceased does not violate the dead man statute as long as the document is authenticated by a source other than an interested witness's testimony." And in this case, the court deemed the informed consent form to have been authenticated by the medical records in which the form was included. Next is the Zervos case on page 8. It has to do with the Supremacy Clause in a lawsuit against President Trump for defamation. The First Department, in a full opinion by Justice Renwick, over a two-justice dissent, held that the Supremacy Clause did not preclude a New York State civil suit for defamation against President Trump. In response to allegations by the plaintiff that Donald Trump had made unwanted sexual advances, then-candidate Trump made statements denying the allegations made by the plaintiff and other women, calling them false and outright lies, saying, for example, all of these liars will be sued after the election is over. The court wrote, "The Supremacy Clause provides that federal law supersedes state law with which it conflicts, but it does not provide that the president himself is immune from state law that does not conflict with federal law." Next case is the Berardi stone setting case. It's on page 9. And it deals with corporation law and a motion to vacate a default judgment. Second Department, reversing the Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to vacate a default judgment should have been granted despite the defendant corporation's failure to update its address with the Secretary of State. The court wrote, "There was no evidence that the defendant corporation received actual notice of the summons that was delivered to the Secretary of State, which does not constitute personal delivery, in time to defend this action. Although the defendant did not explain why it failed to update its address with the Secretary of State, there is no necessity for a defendant moving pursuant to CPLR 317 to show a reasonable excuse for its delay. There is no basis in the record to conclude that the defendant corporation deliberately attempted to avoid service." So the fact that the corporation did not update its information for service with the Secretary of State did not preclude their motion to vacate a default. Next is the Bove case, or Bove case, B-O-V-E. It's on page 10. It's another default, motion to vacate a default case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's attorney's deliberate acts required denial of defendant's motion to vacate the default. The court wrote, "The affirmations of the defendant's attorney reveal that he made a conscious decision not to submit any papers in opposition to plaintiff's motion, even though the Supreme Court gave him ample opportunity to do so. Defense counsel waited until the plaintiff served a proposed default order, more than 4 months after the court declared the defendant to be in default, before serving the defendant's motion to vacate. Under these circumstances, the defendant's failure to oppose the plaintiff's motion was willful." Next is the Brown case, B-R-A-U-N, on pages 10 and 11. It has to do with a slightly late demand for a jury trial. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over an extensive dissent, determined, one, defendant's oral application requesting a jury trial made 1 day late should have been granted, and two, the appeal from a final judgment allows an appeal of the denial of the late application for a jury trial, even though no formal motion on notice was made. The dissent argued that denial was not appealable because there was no formal motion on notice. The court wrote, "An appeal from a final judgment brings up for review any non-final judgment or order which necessarily affects the final judgment," that's CPLR 5501A1. "The parties do not dispute that the order denying defendant's application for leave to file a late demand for a jury trial necessarily affected its final judgment. The state constitution provides for a right to a jury trial in civil cases. Although that right may be waived through the failure to demand it in a timely fashion, see CPLR 4102A, the court may relieve a party from the effect of such waiver if no undue prejudice to the rights of another party would result. While the decision to relieve a party from failing to timely comply with CPLR 4102A lies within the sound discretion of the trial court, we conclude that the court's denial of defendant's application was an abuse of discretion." Next is the Vargas case on pages 11 and 12. It's a discovery case in a medical malpractice action, and it deals with the discovery of a so-called audit trail, which is basically metadata showing who has accessed the plaintiff's medical records, when they were accessed, where they were accessed, and whether any changes were made. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the so-called audit trail, which indicates who accessed plaintiff's medical records, where and when they were accessed, and any changes made to the records, was discoverable in this medical malpractice action. The complaint alleged failure to properly treat plaintiff after surgery, which led to infection and amputation. The court wrote, "Hospitals are required to maintain audit trails under federal and state law. As argued by the plaintiffs, the requested audit trail was relevant to the allegations of negligence that underlie this medical malpractice action, in that the audit trail would provide, or was reasonably likely to lead to, information bearing directly on the post-operative care that was provided to the injured plaintiff. The plaintiffs further demonstrated that such disclosure was also needed to assist preparation for trial by enabling their counsel to ascertain whether the patient records that were eventually provided to them were complete and unaltered." Next is the Felice case, F-E-L-I-C-E, on page 12. It has to do with discovery and orders of preclusion. The Second Department, modifying Supreme Court, held that the sanction imposed for plaintiff's failure to turn over audio files and transcripts she was apparently relying on to prove employment discrimination should not have gone beyond the terms of the conditional order of preclusion. The court said, "Whereas here, a conditional order of preclusion specifies a penalty for the failure to comply, absent a change in circumstances, it is inappropriate for the court to impose a harsher penalty. The Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in barring the plaintiff from offering any evidence for any claim premised on the introduction of, or which relies on, the audio files the plaintiff failed to produce. Instead, the appropriate sanction was the one set forth in the conditional order of preclusion, which precluded the plaintiff from using the audio files and corresponding transcripts at trial unless she produced these items by a date certain, which she failed to do." Next is the Carr Hoagland case, which is on page 13. It's another discovery case. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's decedent's pharmacy records were not protected by physician-patient privilege and must be disclosed to plaintiff, subject to certain limitations and an in-camera review. The plaintiff was injured when her bicycle collided with a vehicle driven by decedent. The court said, "We agree with plaintiffs that decedent's pharmacy records are not protected by the physician-patient privilege, CPLR 4504A, and they are material and necessary to the prosecution of the action, CPLR 3101A. We conclude that plaintiff's request for records before and after the collision was overly broad, and we therefore limit disclosure of the pharmacy records to the six-month period immediately preceding the collision. Those records should not be released to plaintiffs until the court has conducted an in-camera review so that irrelevant information is redacted." Next is the matter of Sheeve versus Holly Volunteer Fire Company. It's on pages 14 and 15. It's an environmental law case, and the civil procedure issue is standing. The Fourth Department held that the petitioner did not have standing to seek a state Environmental Quality Review Act review of a one-day squirrel hunting event put on by a volunteer fire department. The court wrote, "Standing is a threshold requirement for a party seeking to challenge governmental action. The burden of establishing standing to challenge an action pursuant to the State Environmental Quality Review Act is on the party seeking review. The existence of an injury in fact, an actual legal stake in the matter being adjudicated, ensures that the party seeking review has some concrete interest in prosecuting the action. In addition, to establish standing under the State Environmental Quality Review Act, a petitioner must establish an environmental injury that is in some way different from that of the public at large. We conclude that petitioner has not met her burden of establishing an environmental injury in fact. Although petitioner may have alleged some environmental harm, she has alleged at most an injury that is no different in kind or degree from that suffered by the general public." Next is the matter of Ulster County Support Collection Unit on pages 15 and 16. It has to do with the ability to appeal from an order arising from a party's default. The Third Department, dismissing the appeal, explained that where a party in default for failing to appear wishes to appeal, the party must first move to vacate the default. The court said the proper procedure would be for a respondent to move to vacate the default and, if said motion is denied, take an appeal from that order. Because no appeal lies from an order entered on default, we must dismiss this appeal. Next is U.S. Bank on page 16, a foreclosure action, and it has to do with abandonment. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the foreclosure action should not have been dismissed as abandoned pursuant to CPLR 3215C or for neglect to prosecute pursuant to CPLR 3216. The court said, "It's not necessary for a plaintiff to actually obtain a default judgment within 1 year of the default in order to avoid dismissal pursuant to CPLR 3215C. It is enough that the plaintiff timely takes the preliminary step toward obtaining a default judgment of foreclosure by moving for an order of reference to establish that it initiated proceedings for entry of a judgment within 1 year of the default. Within 1 year after the defendant's default, the plaintiff took the preliminary step toward obtaining a default judgment by moving for an order of reference and thus did not abandon this action." The court went on, "The Supreme Court was without power to direct dismissal of the complaint pursuant to CPLR 3216 on the ground of lack of prosecution. While CPLR 3216 authorizes the dismissal of a complaint for neglect to prosecute, joinder of issue and service of a 90-day notice are conditions precedent to a dismissal order under that statute. Here, dismissal was improper as issue was never joined in the action. Next is the Miller case on pages 16 and 17, has to do with sanctions for frivolous actions. The Second Department held that sanctions for frivolous conduct were properly imposed. The action was precluded by collateral estoppel and should never have been brought. The court explained, "The court, in its discretion, may award to any party or attorney in any civil action or proceeding, except where prohibited by law, costs in the form of reimbursement for actual expenses reasonably incurred and reasonable attorney's fees resulting from frivolous conduct. Conduct is frivolous if it is completely without merit in law and cannot be supported by a reasonable argument for an extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, or it is undertaken primarily to delay or prolong the resolution of the litigation, or to harass or maliciously injure another." Here the court said, "Under the circumstances of this case, the court properly determined that the plaintiff and his attorney engaged in frivolous conduct in commencing this action, as it was completely without merit in law and could not be supported by a reasonable argument for extension, modification, or reversal of existing law." Again, the action was precluded on collateral estoppel grounds. Next is the Carbone or Cerbone case, C-E-R-B-O-N-E. It's on page 18. It stands for the proposition that a judge should not rule on an issue that was not raised by either party, a sua sponte ruling. Second Department held that Supreme Court should not have searched the record and awarded summary judgment to the city in this sidewalk slip and fall case because no such motion was before the court. The court wrote, "A court may search the record and grant summary judgment in favor of a non-moving party only with respect to a cause of action or issue that is the subject of the motions before the court. Since no party made any motion with respect to the plaintiff's direct cause of action against the city, the court should not have granted relief with respect to that cause of action." Next is the Iodice case. It's I-O-D-I-C-E on page 19. It has to do with the adequacy of an expert's affidavit in a medical malpractice case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been granted because plaintiff's expert affidavit was conclusory and speculative. In addition, the plaintiff's expert raised an issue that was not discernible from the plaintiff's bill of particulars, and therefore that issue should not have been considered at all. Next is the Meyer case on page 20. It's a student-on-student assault case involving a lawsuit that required a notice of claim because a school district was one of the defendants. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant school district's motion for summary judgment should have been granted in this student-on-student assault case. The assault arose abruptly and lasted 20 to 30 seconds and was not foreseeable. In addition, the theories of liability not mentioned in the notice of claim but asserted in the pleadings should have been dismissed. The court said, by submitting evidence that the notice of claim did not mention causes of action and legal theories, the school district established its entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, dismissing all of the causes of action that were not mentioned in the notice of claim. Next is the Markle case, which is on page 21. It has to do with the privilege afforded materials prepared for litigation. First Department, in a full opinion by Justice Gish, in a matter of first impression, held that the notes taken by an observer at an independent medical exam, called an IME, the exam was of the plaintiff by the defendant's doctor, those notes are protected by the privilege afforded materials prepared for litigation. The observer was hired by plaintiff's attorney and was deemed to be acting as an agent of the attorney. The court said, the IME observer is an agent of the plaintiff's attorney. Consequently, the requested notes and materials constitute materials prepared for trial, bringing them within the conditional or qualified privilege protections of CPLR 3101D. The court went on to say, defendants have not shown any substantial need for the IME observer's notes, or why they are unable, without undue hardship, to obtain the substantial equivalent of the materials by other means. Key to this analysis is that the defendant's doctor conducted plaintiff's examination and can provide defendants with any information concerning what generally occurred and what he did at the IME. Next case is the Bergdorfer case, which is on page 22. It has to do with the court's obligation in considering a summary judgment motion. The First Department noted that even where a cause of action is not properly pled, on a motion for summary judgment, it must search the record to determine whether there is an actionable claim. The court said, a motion for summary judgment must be denied if there are issues of fact as to an actionable claim, even if the claim was not properly pleaded. Next is the matter of Grochulski, Katie Road, LLC. It's on page 23. It has to do with the statute of limitations. The Fourth Department, in a full opinion by Justice Nemoye, determined that the declaratory judgment action was not subject to the four-month statute of limitations for Article 78 actions. The plaintiff and defendant are private parties who own land on opposite sides of Katy Road. A portion of the Katy Road was declared discontinued and defendant allegedly erected a barrier. Plaintiff's action sought Article 78 relief against a town official as well as a declaratory judgment. Because no Article 78 relief was possible with respect to the private defendant who allegedly erected the barrier, the shorter statute of limitations didn't apply to the declaratory judgment action concerning the rights of the private parties. The court said, because an Article 78 proceeding was not the proper vehicle for plaintiff's private claims for declaratory relief, the four-month limitations period is not applicable, and the six-year statute of limitations set forth in CPLR 213.1 applies instead. Next is the Adler case. Another statute of limitations case on page 24. It's out of the Court of Appeals. In a full-fledged opinion by Judge Feinman, the Court of Appeals held that a bond issuer is not obligated to pay interest once a claim for the principal is time-barred. The court wrote, once a claim on the principal is time-barred, a claim to recover unpaid post-maturity interest payments is not legally cognizable. Next is the Kim case on pages 24 and 25. It is a medical malpractice action, another statute of limitations case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's action, which alleged inadequate supervision when plaintiff used a hospital restroom, sounded in medical malpractice, not negligence. Therefore, under the facts, the action was time-barred. The court said, plaintiff alleges that defendants failed to properly assess her condition and the degree of her supervisory needs in the restroom, a claim sounding in medical malpractice, and her action brought 3 years after her injuries is therefore untimely. Next is the Gandham case, G-A-N-D-H-A-M, on page 25. It has to do with subpoenas for non-parties. The Second Department, modifying Supreme Court in this divorce action, determined the subpoena for a non-party was defective because the reasons for the disclosure were not provided. The court said, the subpoenas were defective since, among other things, the defendant failed to provide the non-party with the required explanation of the circumstances or the reasons requiring disclosure, either on the face of the subpoenas or in any accompanying material. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this CLE course. Again, this is the March 29 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet, which collects the summaries of New York State appellate decisions that deal with civil procedure issues, which were released in March 2019. The verification code is subpoena. Again, the verification code for this March 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE course is subpoena. The next case, the Billock versus Union Carbide Corporation case, it's an asbestos exposure case, deals with the admissibility of videotaped deposition testimony from another trial. The Third Department, ordering a new trial, held that the videotaped deposition testimony from proceedings in other states was not admissible in the New York action. It was alleged that plaintiff's decedent died from exposure to asbestos in a joint compound made by Georgia Pacific. An employee of Georgia Pacific, Charles Leonard, who was familiar with the formula for the joint compound, gave the videotaped deposition testimony. The court said, defendant was permitted to introduce deposition testimony given by Leonard in the 2007 Texas state court action for the purpose of demonstrating that it contradicted the 2001 and 2003 testimony that plaintiff had been permitted to introduce as part of its case in chief. However, although defendant was a party to the 2007 Texas action, the plaintiff was not, and he had no opportunity to be present and cross-examine Leonard. So the testimony was not admissible under CPLR 3117A3. And the final case in this CLE course has to do with the Yellowstone injunction and a landlord-tenant dispute. It's the Bliss World LLC case on page 28. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the tenant was not entitled to a Yellowstone injunction because the alleged failure to insure the property and the alleged improper assignment of the lease were not curable defaults. The court said, the purpose of a Yellowstone injunction, which tolls the period in which a tenant may cure a claimed violation of the lease, is for a tenant to avoid forfeiture after a determination against it has been made on the merits, because the tenant will still have an opportunity to cure. A necessary linchpin of a Yellowstone injunction is that the claim default is capable of cure. Where the claim default is not capable of cure, there's no basis for a Yellowstone injunction. Here, the claim defaults are the tenant's failure to procure insurance and improper assignment of the lease. The tenant provides various steps that it will take to cure if it is ultimately found to be in material violation of the insurance provisions of the lease. None of these proposed cures involve any retroactive change in coverage, which means that the alleged defaults raised by the landlord are not susceptible to cure. We reject the tenant's argument that even if no Yellowstone injunction is warranted, it is still entitled to a preliminary injunction. Yellowstone injunctions are available on a far lesser showing than preliminary injunctions. Because the Yellowstone injunction fails, the preliminary injunction does as well. In any event, no injunction is needed to preserve the status quo because the landlord cannot evict the tenant unless and until there's a determination on the merits in the landlord's favor. If the tenant prevails, then there will be no eviction. The right lost by the denial of a Yellowstone injunction is the right to cure any default. And that concludes this CLE course, which again is based on the New York State appellate decisions dealing with civil procedure released in the month of March 2019. And the summaries of those decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website and compiled in a March 2019 civil procedure update pamphlet.